I hate speaking when I don't know what the context is, and I've missed the context. So I'm just going to go for it. When I was briefed on this, I told I had between 5 and 10 minutes. And I took that absolutely literally and went more for the 5 than the 10, which is probably good, given that that's probably all I've got.
5 or 10.
5 or 10. 5 will probably be more like it. As you probably know, I wrote this book called The Fourth Pillar, which has become mainstream in some weird way, which is most peculiar to someone like me, as you can tell by looking at me, and by my atrocious timing. But given that, in a sense, now that UCLG has adopted the fourth pillar and it's become fully mainstream and practical and all those sort of things, I'm off the hook. I can move on, so to speak. But in moving on, I need to pay a whole bunch of tributes in terms of the fourth pillar. Tributes that people tend to forget about. The first one is to the two people who invented, who coined the phrase, the fourth pillar of sustainability. And they were David Yenken and Deborah Wilkinson in their book Resetting the Compass, published in 2000. Thankfully, David Yenken is also a Melbourne person, so we are able to claim the concept, the fourth pillar, as a absolutely local Melbourne idea. Secondly, I would like to pay tribute to Jude Spokes, who was the founding director of the Cultural Development Network, who was the one who commissioned me in those days with relatively large amounts of money to write a book about culture and local government, and then told me to go away and write it, which I then did, and I think what she got was nothing like what she expected, but it turned out to become this sort of cult object, which we were all very pleased about. And finally, and most importantly really, I should pay tribute to Jordi Pasquale, the support officer of the UCLG's Barcelona-based Committee for Culture, who for the last 10 years has burrowed away trying to convince the UCLG to adopt culture as the fourth pillar, and finally, at the end of last year, achieved that end. And if it hadn't have been for Jordi, none of this would have happened. Now, so I'm gratified that the fourth pillar is now this sort of big deal, but I'm gratified for a sort of negative reason. And the first one is that I think the purpose of the purpose that I had in writing the fourth pillar, I have comprehensively failed in. You are looking at a failure. Because possibly the one thing that, well, there were two things. So the first thing that I wanted to demonstrate in the fourth pillar was that cultural policy was a nonsense. And given the title of this session, I've clearly failed. The whole point of the fourth pillar was to say that rather than thinking about cultural policy, we should be thinking about a cultural framework. We should be thinking about a framework, a lens, through which we look at all policy. That all policy should be evaluated from a cultural perspective, just as all policy should be evaluated from an environmental, a social, and an economic perspective. And that's not happening, and I'm glad to be able to move on to other things, because I don't think it ever is going to happen. We are going to be stuck with cultural policy. My second major failure was in the nature of cultural policy itself. In the fourth pillar, I argued that more often than not, cultural policy is simply arts policy under another name. And so it continues to be. Now, if one were going to have a real cultural policy, it would probably have two major focuses. One, the family, secondly, the education system, and possibly, thirdly, the mass media. To me, those are the three major engines of cultural development. Arts, though interesting and my first love, is relatively insignificant in the development of culture in any society. The family is probably the most profound area of development. The education system is the most socialised way, and one might say the mass media is the most capitalised way. And the arts are way off in the corner. So if one were to have real cultural policy, that would be where the focus is. The focus isn't there. The focus is on arts and heritage. Now, I don't have a problem with arts and heritage policies. In fact, they are the ones that interest me the most. But they are not cultural policy. Can I have some water? I'm doing all right, really, aren't I, given that I was panicking like you wouldn't believe 10 minutes ago. Where am I? Yes, done that. So, the other reason I'm glad to get out of here is that what I've noticed that is now happening is what one might call pillar swinging competition. My pillar is longer than yours. Now, the economists have been doing that forever. It's all about the economy, stupid. Environmentalists got into the act. Everything, when it comes down to it, is about the environment. Social scientists, and I wish I'd been here for the speaker before last, because I have a suspicion that social scientists are doing exactly the same thing. Everything is about the social. And I have bumped into not a few cultural workers who, rather timidly but nevertheless strongly, argue that everything really rests on culture. Now, this, I mean, given this phallic imagery of the four pillars ends up being a swinging competition, one of the ways out of this is to think Egyptian, which is simply to build a pyramid with a triangular bottom, a tetrahedron, four-sided tetrahedron. Put culture, da-da-da-da-da, on each of the four sides, toss it in the air, and it's always going to land on a base, and each time it'll be a different one. I guess what I'm saying is everything is cultural, everything is social, everything is economic, everything is environmental. They are integrated. We need to be able to think in all those four areas simultaneously. So I want to get out of the pillar swinging arena. So what the UCLG's declaration allows me to do is return to my first love, which is art. But a very particular sort of art. If you go to my website, you will see that I have two obsessions. One is a useful definition of culture. And I should say that there's an interesting thing about that the definition, the wider definition of culture that is beginning to emerge is that it's about values. It's all about values. I've become increasingly cynical about values. I think values are utterly speculative. That values are what people tell you they believe. The reality is, how do they behave? Not what do they believe, how do they behave? Culture is about behaviour, not about beliefs. So, why am I saying that? I'm not sure, other than I felt it necessary to say that values, you know, people can claim all sorts of things. But when it comes down to it, it's the walk. It's the walk that counts, not the talk. And I'm glad that from here on in, other people will be doing the talking and I won't have to, and I can start talking about my second obsession, art, but in particular, the value of democratised arts practice or art making by everyone. And art isn't the most important word in that phrase. Making is the first important one, and everyone is the next important one. Art comes a distant third. So I'm now talking about what I think I'm meant to be talking about, which is the sequel. What am I going to do next? I'm going to tell you, which is that I'm going to write about art making. Now, what I've discovered in thinking about these things is that you go to the literature about the value of art, and all of the literature about the value of art is about the value of consuming art, the value of looking at art, the value of listening to art. It's all about consumption. Now, that's all very well. I love going to concerts, I love going to theatre, I love consuming art. But it runs a distant last to making art. And I hesitate. No, I don't. I revel in using a sexual analogy here. And I would say that the difference between singing and going to a concert and watching other people singing is not all that different between the difference between making love and going and watching other people make love. Now, we know in our heart of hearts immediately that the difference between sexual intercourse and pornography, we know the difference. We know that one is titillating, but really, when it comes down to it, the true function of this activity is in the doing of it. Why don't we understand the same thing about art? I don't understand. I don't know why we don't, other than that there's been this massive century-long rhetoric about how important it is to look at this stuff. Not to do it yourself, but to look at what other people have done. Very strange. So my mission in life from this moment on is to get back to the idea that all of us can, should and are able to make art. And I've been told I've got 2 minutes to go, so I think I'm actually going to stop. No, I'll run through my dot points of what it's going to be, given I've got 2 minutes. I have that. So the first thing I want to argue is the importance and value of participatory and collaborative art making. And that's a great subject to get into, and it is so different from all of the value of art stuff that I've ever seen. In fact, some of you might remember John Carey's book, What Good Are the Arts? And basically he comes down to saying he can't think there's any good in it at all. There's hardly any benefit that you can actually identify. And what he's talking about is what is the good of witnessing the arts? He doesn't even think about what the good is in making it. So that's the first thing. Second thing is to try and tie the value of art making into a series of independent and other ways of thinking about humanity. The two most important ones, I think, are needs. There's a whole body of needs theory now that I think art making can tie into perfectly, which I intend to do. And then there's cultural rights. There's a whole bunch of cultural rights where we've written down some sort of concept of universal rights in the area of culture to try and make very clear what the connections between rights and art making are. So that's the second thing. Third thing is the value of art making to local government, that the processes of groups of people making art together have very practical benefits for local government, which I won't go into now because I've only got like 30 seconds left, so that's going to be chapter three. Fourthly, the need for government to review its support for the arts priorities. Now, nearly all those priorities are based on a version of the arts as an industry, and I think that's tragic. They need to be turned over. That rather than thinking about keeping places and artists with a capital A, we should be thinking about the fertile ground out of which the arts, with the capitals, grow. In other words, the communities themselves. Now, football, professional football, knows full well then the only way you're going to keep 100,000 people in the MCG when you run a grand final is if you have AusKick running every week throughout the winter. In other words, the people that support the arts need to be as informed and as comfortable with the activity as the experts are. Sport knows that perfectly. We need to learn that ourselves. So there's a whole bunch of priorities that need to change. Next one, approaches to engagement and resisting anti-creative tendencies in bureaucracies. Now, as we all know, bureaucracies are quite properly designed to make things secure, measurable, predictable, all those words. And it's perfectly reasonable that bureaucracy does that. But you've got to admit, that is not a ground in which creative activity is likely to flower. So one has to work out a way of creativity and bureaucracy being able to dance together. And I'm being told to wind up. So I have one more thing, and that is to try and identify the resources that communities need in order to be creative. And I've got about 20 of them, and none of them are money. There are all sorts of other things that people need. Thank you very much, and I'm so sorry for being late.
Thanks, John, or Jono. Weren't that late, and you just filled it in nicely. We'll take a couple of minutes into the coffee break for questions on that. If anybody needs instructions on between doing and watching, we'll leave that till later. But other areas of what John spoke about and also what Mike spoke about, if you've got questions, that may, we do have a roving mic. We'll take in a little bit of our coffee time on that. Frank, at the back, can you take a mic to the back? Thanks. You got one there. Good.
So, Jono, given your intervention and given that the federal government is in the process of consultations for a national cultural policy, I'd be curious to know what you think your submission to that might be or if you're even going to put one in. Because I have to say that I tend to agree with you the notion of the conflation of arts into a cultural policy.
Is it on?
Is it on?
Yep.
Do I need it?
Yep.
All right. I made a submission on behalf of the CDN to the original cultural policy thing, which was, of course, totally ignored. It's a weird irony that the guy that's responsible for this development, the new policy, a guy called Steve Cassidy, was an Art and Working Life staff officer when I was the director of the Community Arts Board. And we, that is the Community Arts Board and its cohorts, were responsible, tragically, for turning community arts into an industry and professionalising it and creating career paths and all that sort of thing. An activity that once was feral and revolutionary in various sort of ways became normalised, which is the way of the world, I guess. My reading of what's been written so far is that the way that the federal cultural policy direction is heading is absolutely industrial. It is thinking of the arts as an industry. In other words, there are arts workers. Arts workers make commodities. The job of government is to support the industry, and that the industry is a thing that produces this stuff that then gets consumed by the market. Now, you know, that's fine, but it's not a world I'm interested in, so I won't be making any submission at all. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Look, Mike and his presentation just before and earlier in mine, we talked about the issue of developing aspirational communities and aspirational culture and the link of culture aspiration. Now, it seems from what you say to your thinking is along connecting culture with those aspirations. Can you just talk about aspirational communities and cultures and the link with culture specifically?
Well, I wish I'd heard what he'd said. Because what you've just said sounds very much up my alley. I think certainly the one of the functions
It's interesting. I talk about in one of those sort of charts that I wrote about how you, which are on the website, about, you know, how you put things together. I say culture and planning are the same thing. That planning, the idea of imagining a future, which is basically what planning is about, is in fact a fundamentally cultural activity. They're the same thing. That imagining a future, to think, now what is it where do we want to go? What do we want to be like? Is, you know, the planning department ought to be in the Department of Culture. It's that obvious, really. I don't know if that's really answering your question, but it's sort of in that mode.
Other questions?
Thank you. My name is Sarah Dugdale. I'm a Kiwi working in a southeast Melbourne local government. One of the big differences, Mike, is when you are putting reports before the politicians in New Zealand, you do need to address those four bottom lines. And I have really missed that because business is business in local government and is still driven primarily by economics. But having that opportunity to make a case for the creative cultural well-being of your community is actually incredibly empowering for the sector in our community that are not sports and rec. It's just an opportunity that I've missed, and I wonder if that was an intent to keep that sort of thing and possibly do a big sell across the Tassie.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I tend to agree with that. Yes, I think it has been really one of the important things that have flowed out of the 2002 reforms. And it hasn't, as far as I can see, it hasn't been weakened at all over recent years, even though our current government, which has got a really single focus on making the economy grow faster and, you know, and doesn't really like anything that gets in the way, and it has kind of played around with our legislation, as I mentioned very briefly, our legislation which outlines how councils should go about their strategic planning, which in 2002 was very much a bottom-up process which allowed communities to define their outcomes, you know, in John's terms, really, you know, define the culture of your places, to the point where it said, actually, you know, that seems to be very time-consuming. let's let the councils do that. But it's also quite empowering, and we will see we're watching how that's going to develop over the next year, but my picture would be that we'll see within the country quite a difference between those councils which are still very much focused about building from the bottom up, you know, with their communities and identifying aspirations, and those other local authorities perhaps who say, well, our basic job, and this is again maybe a good feature of the culture of those communities too, our basic job is to figure out how to keep the roads going and the water and wastewater, and that's going to be what we do, and you know. So we'll probably see a greater distinction between how councils move in the future. But again, the government is being very nicely hands-off, which is good. Thank you.
There's just one last question from Martin in the middle.
Hello, Martin Mulligan from RMIT University. Look, just it's a little story, actually, to link, I think, what Mike's saying to something that John's been also saying, which is I was once in the Te Papa Museum, the wonderful museum, and you're talking about the potential of Maori culture, which in ways challenges our notions of culture. Because I was in this museum, and as you'd know, there's a brilliant old meeting house. I think it's 140 years old or something. And I was sitting there admiring this as it's presented as a commodity. And in walk a group of school children, mostly Maori, and spontaneously they started dancing and singing in that space. The place became alive, and the Maori school students were energised by the place, so much so that they were just, you know, yelling with delight. And I was privileged to watch this. In other words, this ancient meeting house suddenly came alive by a practice, as John's saying, became not a commodity, but an actual, you know, sphere of theatre, which I was lucky enough spontaneously to witness. And it was a brilliant thing to see. And that is, I think, the difference between the way we think about culture and culture as an everyday practice.
I'd just like you to take a moment just to thank our speakers, Mike Reed, John Hawkes, and for Paul James, who's left earlier. Thank you very much.